Welcome back to the program. In yesterday's New York Times, David Brooks had an insightful column about how individuals matter. He reminded us that while we have a tendency to see history as driven by deep historical forces, and sometimes it is, but sometimes it is driven by completely inexplicable individuals who combine qualities you would think could never come together. In some ways, we could make this case about Barack Obama, but perhaps more importantly, we can make it about his mother, Anne Dunham, a woman truly ahead of her time. She defined and defied the boundaries of single motherhood. She made her own decision. She had great success, yet no plan. She made lists of what she wanted to accomplish, yet seemed to improvise every step of her life. She had her own ideas about what it meant to be a good mother, and it certainly resulted in giving her a good son. She was, in the title of Janny Scott's brilliant biography of her, a singular woman. Janny Scott was a reporter for the New York Times from 1994 to 2008. She was a member of the New York Times team that won the 2000 Pulitzer Prize for national reporting. She wrote numerous stories on then-Senator Obama when he was running for president. It is my pleasure to have Janny Scott here to talk about her new book, A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Janny Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. It's great to be here.
Pleasure to have you here. Those of us that have been following Barack Obama's career for a while and 3 years or so into his presidency, sometimes still don't feel we completely understand him. After 2.5 years of researching his mother, do you have a better idea of who Barack Obama is?
Well, I think it's safe to say that to understand his mother better is to shed light on him, and that is one of the interesting things about this subject. We knew so little about her for so long. She was, in this sort of public imagination and the imagination of the media, just the white mother from Kansas, always the kind of counterpoint to the black father from Kenya. And then during the campaign, she became the single mother on food stamps or the woman who died of cancer while fighting her insurance company. Sort of a couple of neat, tidy stereotypes that that really obscured a far more complicated and interesting story. So she was, as you say, just an extraordinary kind of pathbreaker in many ways, and to understand that story really sheds light on him.
And yet, as extraordinary as she in fact was, in many ways the campaign, as you were referring to before, kind of was very happy to have those simple stereotypes out there. There has never really been an attempt, really prior to your book, to really explain who Anne Dunham was.
That's right. It's the first book on her, and you know, maybe that's just the nature of political campaigns. The fact is, if you think about it, we don't know about too many candidates' mothers. The thing that's striking in her case is that she's such a different story. You know, as the basic outline, I think, is known by some Americans, she, at 17, conceived a child in 1960 with an African at a time when nearly 24 states had laws against interracial marriage. She moved to Indonesia in 1967 with her 6-year-old son at a time when there was enormous social and political upheaval there and hundreds of thousands of Indonesians had been killed. She became an anthropologist working in small villages in Java where Western women were rarely, if ever, seen, specializing in the study of a handicraft that was largely a male occupation. She raised her children very differently than many Americans do, taking her son abroad, sending him back to his grandparents to go to an American school, homeschooling her daughter until 7th grade. So over and over again, she did things sort of by her own rules.
And yet the remarkable thing is, when you go through that litany, the interracial marriage, going to Indonesia when she did, raising 2 kids as a graduate student and single mother, one is led to think that maybe there was some kind of a plan there, some kind of a vision there, but in fact, so much of it was improvisational.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that's such a striking thing. I think when we look back on a life as different as this, and a life that left a big mark, not only in her son, but also through her work, we think that this is a visionary. But I don't get that impression from the people who knew her as she went along. I really think she was making hard decisions like many of us do, day to day. How do I educate my children? You know, how do I balance the fact that I've fallen in love with a man who's from a completely different culture? How do I, you know, do work that is important and satisfying to me, but also make enough money to give my children the kind of education I think they deserve? So it really was an improvisation. And as she herself was willing to say in a wonderful letter she wrote to a friend in 1973, she was trying to get him to tell her a bit more about how his life had been in the intervening years since she'd seen him. She said, you know, kind of cajoling him, she said, you know, don't hold back. I've screwed up royally myself more than once.
And yet, it, far from having any kind of a plan, the president himself refers to his mother as kind of a naive idealist.
Yeah, I asked the president about that when I interviewed him in last summer, because I felt there was a general impression of her in the public mind as naive, exactly that, a naive idealist. And I felt that it kind of came from his characterization of her in his book. And he said, well, I did think of her that way, and I do, but I don't think of it as a pejorative. He felt that her idealism and her, what he described as naivete, was a source of great resilience in her. And so while she did occasionally stumble, she was able to get back on her feet and keep moving forward. He really has a very interesting, complicated relationship to her legacy. He ultimately, in the interview, told me a wonderful story about how he was reminded of her on the night of the Iowa caucuses, and how what reminded him was this extraordinary scene there with these very diverse population and a feeling of optimism and hope on that night, because it was the night where they suddenly realized that they possibly could win. And he said, you know, it reminded me of that feeling of hers, that we can reach across these vast divides and actually speak to each other, and that there's more good than bad in all of us. And he said, I guess that's really the naive idealism I'm talking about. And then he said, and I think it's the naive idealism in me.
More than idealism, it's almost a sense of optimism that she seemed to carry with her, that the decisions that she would make would somehow find a way of working themselves out.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And sometimes to a fault, you know. The president himself said that she seemed to always have that feeling and relied too much on her own parents to bail her out, certainly financially, and taking, you know, charge of her children at various junctures, that she perhaps thought things would always work out, and they don't necessarily work out. In her case, she was lucky, and they did. And she had wonderful support from her parents.
You give us an insight of a pretty chaotic, or at least chaotic in terms of being in motion all the time, early childhood with her parents. She moved a lot. There was always a sense of something new happening. She was always kind of the outsider. Talk a little about that.
Well, that's right. Her father was a furniture salesman. I don't think he was particularly successful. I don't know whether he was actually losing jobs or just constantly wanting better jobs, but she was born in Kansas. They moved out to California so that he could go to college, but he dropped out and went back to Kansas. And then they went to Oklahoma, then Texas, back to Kansas, then out to Seattle, where she went to high school. So there was, for her, an experience of always being the outsider and never fully belonging. And that, I think, on top of a natural temperament toward a kind of cerebral view of the world, I think that experience shaped her character in interesting ways. So by the time she arrived in high school, she had a wonderfully ironic sense of humor, apparently, very wry. She did not feel particularly powerfully drawn to try to comply with the sort of local, you know, the dominant culture in the high school. So she was a little bit the participant observer, which ultimately is what she became as an anthropologist. And that, I suppose, propelled her further in the rest of her life as being what the president refers to as sort of the expatriate existence, being that of a perpetual outsider, of an observer. And he felt it was sort of that is a life that in which you're not fully committed necessarily. I don't know that that's true in her case, but there's a difference between them there, that he did not embrace that outsider status, at least to the degree that she did.
In fact, in his case, there's always this sense of one foot wanting to be in the outsider world, wanting to be in the observer position, but yet too much the conformist, too much part of the world to want to give that up as well.
Yeah, he said that while he credited her with shaping a lot of his values, in particular his value, the value of public service and her belief in that the most important thing in life was to try to give opportunity to people who didn't have it, while he inherited those things from her, he made a very clear decision not to adopt the same kind of life pattern that she did in terms of her expatriate life. He said he made a very conscious decision to move to Chicago, root himself in Chicago, marry a woman from Chicago, and place as in their life a sort of primary value on creating stability for their children. That's a very different choice than the one his mother made.
She didn't have a lot of close relationships or really boyfriends, so it seems, in high school, so that when she was at the University of Hawaii and she met Barack Obama Sr., the speed of that relationship was quite remarkable.
It's really true. Yeah, none of her high school friends remembered her ever having a boyfriend, and a graduate student friend of hers, who Anne had told about this later, said that she was a virgin when she met Barack Obama Sr. She had just arrived in Hawaii in the summer of 1960. He had been on campus as the first African student for the past year. He was a remarkably charismatic, quite brilliant man with a fantastic voice, as people described him, very, very seductive voice. And they met, I think it must have been within the first few weeks of her being a freshman, a 17-year-old freshman on that campus. And by November, she was pregnant.
Talk a little bit about that and how her parents reacted to that.
That's a hard thing to know. President Obama has written in his memoir, and I guess in perhaps other places as well, that his mother told him that they were initially quite upset, but possibly they kind of came around to the idea that, well, sit tight and this will pass. And it did. But her parents were not what you might imagine for that period. They were somewhat unconventional themselves. While they had come from small towns in Kansas, they had left very quickly. Her mother, interestingly, had married a man that her parents didn't like either, Stanley Dunham. And she had immediately kind of bolted for the West Coast with him after marrying in secret in high school. So the interesting thing about Madeline Dunham, the grandmother of Barack Obama, who we all knew about during the campaign before she died, is that she has some of the rebellious streaks that you see in her daughter.
To what extent did his mother, Ann Dunham, think about Barack Obama Jr., Barry's racial identity?
You know, you almost never encounter much evidence that that was really in her mind terribly. I mean, yes, she tried to expose him to, as he's written, to certain literature, African-American literature and the history of important African-Americans, and that she wanted him to have a she certainly wanted him to have a connection with his father. She very much kept alive in his mind an idea of his father, and she encouraged, I think, them to write to each other. When Barack Obama was 10, she arranged for Barack Sr. to come to Hawaii and spend that period with him that's described in his book. And yet one man who knew her very well in Indonesia recalled meeting her son in Jakarta at her house. He was back there on vacation while she was working at the Ford Foundation there, and he was, I think, startled to see that he was black. So I don't think it was that Anne. I don't think Anne spoke about him in that way. While she encouraged an understanding of his heritage between him and her, and when they, you know, in educating him, I don't think she spoke to her friends about that in any kind of conscious way. He was just her son.
Did that surprise you when you uncovered that? I mean, because certainly even in his memoir, you get the sense of Barack Obama Jr. at that stage of his life still trying to come to grips with, to work out his own racial identity.
My guess is it might have been more of an issue for him than it was for her. And maybe that's the luxury of the white parent in that situation, that she could afford to think that it was irrelevant, and perhaps he thought that in the long run in life it's not going to be irrelevant. It doesn't surprise me knowing what I know about her, because I really think a woman who marries a Kenyan, then marries an Indonesian, moves to Indonesia, has later in life other relationships with Indonesians, was not thinking a lot about skin color.
Talk about the move to Indonesia and her second marriage.
Well, after her marriage with Barack Obama broke up, she became involved with a man named Lolo Sutoro, who was an Indonesian student at the University of Hawaii, a graduate student studying geography. They met, I think, in about 1963, were married in 1964, and then in 1965, there was what is described as a kind of a coup and counter-coup in Indonesia that led to the sidelining and eventual overthrow of Sukarno, and to this terrible period of bloodshed in which there was sort of anti-communist slaughter in the countryside. And he, all foreign students who were abroad at that time were called back to Indonesia, and Lolo Sutoro, who had been sent there through some kind of government sponsorship, then owed the Indonesian government a number of years of service, so he went into the army. And Anne had not finished her undergraduate studies at the University of Hawaii, so she and Barack stayed behind, and then in 1967 moved there to join Lolo. And that is the period that's covered in the beginning of President Obama's memoir,
right.
Period where they were living in Jakarta, and the marriage between Anne and Lolo begins to fray. Eventually, she ends up moving back to Hawaii.
One of the things that's so interesting about the fraying of that second marriage is how different he becomes when he is back at home, a very different person than he was as a foreign student at the University of Hawaii.
Yeah, that is an interesting story. Many other people who had been at the East-West Center, which was the institution that had brought him to the University of Hawaii at that time, said that that is not an uncommon thing, that people from Asian cultures who came there were free to behave in a different way when they were in the United States. They were outside of the normal constraints of their culture, of their families. But then they would go back, and they would have to readapt. And in Lolo Sutoro's case, he not only had to readapt to the expectations of his large, extended Javanese family, but he also had, there were political pressures on him because of the period it was in Indonesia, the opportunity he'd been given to go abroad. So he had a lot of pressure on him that had not existed in Hawaii. And I think that bore down on him, changed him as a personality. He became quieter and more withdrawn. And I think Anne was disappointed in what she found when she got there, and also entered into a very lonely period where she just didn't have the kind of close, intimate relationship with him that she'd had in Hawaii.
Talk a little bit about something that has always been so controversial with respect to her, and that is her decision to send Barack Obama Jr. back to Hawaii at the age of 10 to really get a good English education.
Yes, a lot of Americans find it baffling that a mother could do this. I found when I looked into the circumstances that there were many conflicting factors in that decision, and that it was a very difficult decision for her. He had been in Indonesia for 4 years at the time and had been in a couple of Indonesian schools. He didn't have access to the one big English language international school that existed there, the Jakarta International School, at that time. So she didn't really have much choice but to put him in the schools that she did. Those were schools taught in Indonesian, where classes were taught in Indonesian, and she very strongly believed he needed a solid English language education in order to have access to a great university that would open up his opportunities in life. She came from a family that believed deeply in education. So she finally decided there was no choice but to send him back. Her parents lived a couple of blocks from Punahou, the school he eventually went to, which is a very good prep school in Hawaii. So her parents were able to get him into that school. So he had an opportunity to go to a great school and live with his grandparents. She, in the meantime, was married to an Indonesian, and she had a second child who was the daughter of that husband. So she couldn't just move back to Hawaii herself and, you know, cut all ties in order to be with her son. So she sent him back, and then she kind of extricated herself and arranged for herself to go back and do graduate work at the University of Hawaii while her son was in middle school. And she went back initially with Lolo Sutoro, her husband, and Maya. Lolo ended up leaving and going back to Indonesia, so the three of them were there for the next couple of years. And then it came to high school. He was about to enter high school, and she had finished her graduate coursework, and if she wanted to get her PhD, which she wanted to do because she wanted to work as an anthropologist, she had to go and do her field work. And she had decided on a subject, and that required work that she would do in Java. In the meantime, her daughter's father was in Java. So once again, she's sort of torn between, you know, two very remote locations and children that have connections to both places. So she's juggling a lot of things. And while I think some people find, as I say, those decisions confusing, even alienating, they're much more complex than we normally have given them credit.
What's so fascinating about them is that when you look at them in the context of the 21st century, if you look at them from the point of view of today, juggling all of this travel back and forth and all of it, it seems more normal. When you put it in the context of the time it all took place, it's quite remarkable.
It is. You're absolutely right. I've always been struck by how many of the problems that Anne Dunham wrestled with are problems that women of subsequent generations could really find familiar. I have to say, while they were unusual in the years that she was doing these things, the world was moving in that direction, and there were always people who lived abroad and had to deal with the fact of how to educate their children. Many of them sent their children to boarding schools. That was not in the culture of her family, and that's not how she chose to handle it.
To what extent was she aware of the changes that were taking place in the U.S. at the time, the civil rights movement, the rise of feminism, so many of the changes that she, in her own innocent and, again, perhaps naive and idealistic way, was at the cutting edge of?
Yeah, a friend of hers in Indonesia said to me, well, the women's movement happened while we were working. she, as though they were busy living their lives, and these things were happening, but they weren't terribly in tune with them. The civil rights movement had really begun while Anne was still in high school, even though she was off in Seattle and then in Hawaii, and it was perhaps less acutely felt there, but she was aware of the civil rights movement, which I think technically is sort of 55 to 65 or so. And she graduated from high school in 1960. The women's movement, she really did antedate that, and I don't think that she was particularly thought much about that or was particularly in tune to it. She eventually said to her daughter Maya, who had gone to her in her early 20s to say she was thinking of marrying someone and asking sort of what her mother thought about this, and her mother said, you know, you need to do what you choose to do and what is important for you, but I think you need to know that when you decide to marry, you have to know yourself well enough, and sometimes that takes some years. And she said, you know, sometimes women seem to live as though we went through this whole women's movement, and yet women still seem to live as though it didn't happen and as though they had no choices. Almost as if those things were just sort of naturally occurring in her as they were occurring in a movement somewhere else.
Was she comfortable with who she was?
I think so. I have heard very little evidence to the contrary, and I think to live that kind of life, I mean, it's an interesting question because you might say, well, she wasn't comfortable with who she was, and that's why she chose to live in another culture. I don't think so. I was always told, even as a child, that she had a wonderful sort of sense of humor about herself and a kind of frankness that suggests, I'm thinking of one particular thing that a friend of hers said to me. She met her in high school, and Anne, who was called Stanley at the time, because her real name was Stanley Anne, she dropped the Stanley when she got to college, introduced herself and said, you know, my name is Stanley Anne, and the woman who's telling me said, and I remember very well how she said, yeah, my father wanted a boy, but he got me. And I said, how did she say that? And she said it as though she had nothing to hide. And I think that was really the way she was. She, while she had this sort of outsider-insider tension in her life, she was pretty clear about who she was.
And, of course, the overriding thing about her is this remarkable resiliency that you just see over and over and over again.
That's really true. Her mother, oddly enough, the president's grandmother, when Anne was in high school, said to a friend of Anne's, we Dunhams, we usually bob to the surface. And the friend remembered this, you know, years later when I was interviewing him, because he felt it was so prescient about really what happened with Anne. She was a person who didn't have a lot of regrets. She did not dwell on her regrets. In fact, the people who were close to her say they really never heard her even saying negative things about the husbands whom she had divorced. that she thought of these as sort of experience that was part of your life, and it had been, you know, wonderful, and it had produced wonderful things, and life had moved on. So I think that sort of ability to, and maybe it's almost innate, that kind of optimism that things will work out, while it can be a negative at times, I think for her it really carried her forward.
Jenny Scott, the book is A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Jenny, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Jeff. It was enjoyable.
Thank you.